situation where we try and recap all of the material, which by the time we get to the fifth show, we're going to be spending the first 2 hours of the broadcast recapping the material. We're going to touch on these points a little more lightly. Again, those of you who are just tuning in and are very interested, this has all been gone out. It is all available from Davcor, the tape service. We will give the address again before the end of the show. You know, don't worry about it. If there's something that you missed, you can get a hold of the tapes. But again, we cannot, we've already had 15 hours of programming on this. We cannot recap all of it, obviously.
By the way, on this evening's broadcast, unlike the last two, we should have some time for phone calls. Maybe not a whole lot, but if people do have some questions, they will probably have a chance to ask us at the during the latter stages of the show this evening.
Absolutely. Now, what we have been doing so far is we have been tracing originally the historical connections between the Vatican and fascism. Again, not necessarily the Catholic Church, but the Vatican and fascism. And we started in the first broadcast talking about the very early compliance of a man named Eugenio Pacelli, who became a cardinal, who was very influential, he and his brother, in negotiating the Lateran Treaty in 1929 that reestablished the position of the Vatican in regards to the Italian state in quite a different way. It was an accommodation made with Mussolini's fascist government, but it also removed the Vatican from the normal sphere of Italian legal affairs and, in another way, even more importantly perhaps, from Italian financial affairs, and it garnered for the Vatican a lump sum of money during the time of the signing of that treaty that enabled the Vatican to set up what has been called by many people Vatican Inc. Vatican Incorporated is actually the Institute for Religious Works, the IOR, or as it's sometimes called, the Vatican Bank. And the Vatican Bank has become one of the major players in world financial circles. Now, this is important because, as we noted, during the time of the rise of fascism, Cardinal Pacelli eventually himself rose to become Pope Pius XII, who was a very compliant pope in terms of getting along with fascism, and in fact was a dyed-in-the-wool anti-communist, and always believed that Nazism was preferable to anything even remotely smacking of socialism or leftist activity. And because of that, not only did he stand silent as the Jews of Italy were dragged out and sent away to concentration camps, and as the partisans were murdered in the Ardentine caves and things of that nature, but in fact he actively helped, or at least stood by with full knowledge, as other members of the Vatican, most notably a Cardinal Montini, who later became Pope Paul VI, all of these folks collaborated in enabling the Nazis to get out of Europe. Okay, now, before I turn it over to Dave, a couple of very important names to note here, besides Pacelli and Giovanni Montini, who later became Pope Paul VI, working with those folks, one very important character by the name of Licio Gelli, G-E-L-L-I. Licio Gelli is going to go on to become the head of the P2 Propaganda Due Masonic Lodge. Its relation to Masonic Lodge, to the Masons in general, is only mostly circumstantial. The secrecy of Masonry was helpful, but other than that, basically what it was a shadow fascist government of Italy, the P2 Lodge, made up of Italian intelligence, military, business, and religious officials, and working in concert with the same types of people in other countries all over the world, but most notably in Argentina and Monaco, and because of this, able to put together a massive web of financial and political speculation that wormed its tentacles, to use some dramatic terminology, into political events all over the world, all uniformly on the side of fascism.
Now, one of the things to remember is that as a result of the early pattern of cooperation that Nip was describing, namely the Lateran Treaty, the Vatican acquired a great deal of money. The banking of that money was accomplished to a considerable extent by two men named Michele Sindona and Roberto Calvi, both doctrinaire fascists, both with connections to organized crime, and both of them members of Licio Gelli's P2 Lodge. Now, they were called in to handle the Vatican financing by Pope Paul VI, previously Cardinal Montini, whose very election was as Pope, that is, was affected to a considerable extent by some manipulations by not only Licio Gelli, but also his number two man in the P2 Lodge, a man named Umberto Ortolani. Now, one of the patterns that will be running throughout this series, and that we're going to be looking at again at great length this evening, is a cooperative pattern which involves the Vatican, or elements thereof, in this case the or related atom elements, in this case the P2 Lodge, U.S. intelligence, German Nazi elements. And we're going to be looking at these this tangle, which we began looking at the tail end of World War II with Operation Bernhard, the Nazi forging operation to finance the exit of Nazis out of Europe. And we then looked at that at great length last week, where we looked at a number of different machinations affected by a combination of the P2 Lodge, U.S. intelligence, and in some cases German fascists as well, primarily the Galen organization. We looked at a program called the Strategy of Tension, which basically was a pattern of bombings that the P2 Lodge and elements thereof, including notably a man named Stefano Della Chiai, basically the strategy of tension was a program to drive the Italian political spectrum into the arms of the fascists by staging a bunch of bombings and blaming them on the left. Stefano Della Chiai was one of the main people we looked at there, and the influence of the P2 on the Italian security services is going to be, was front and center last week. It's going to be front and center this week as well. Also, U.S. intelligence and their involvement with P2. And the strategy of tension is very important to think about as we contemplate the Pope shooting, which we will be getting into in a hard sense for the first time in this broadcast, because the elements of the Pope shooting appear very consistent with the strategy of tension. It appears to have been a right-wing crime, that which obviously with the Bulgarian brouhaha has been blamed on the left or on the Soviets. And the strategy of tension is one of the main things to remember as we talk about the Pope shooting.
Okay, now, as mentioned by Dave, one of the main, the backing sources for the strategy of tension, much of it was directed by members of the P2, the Propaganda Due Masonic Lodge. Again, a Masonic lodge mostly out of convenience. Basically, you can think of it as a fascist government within a government. Now, among the most important high rollers connecting the Propaganda Due Masonic Lodge to the Vatican and to the machinations of the Holy City itself were two men who we mentioned at great length in the last few shows, Michele Sindona and Roberto Calvi. Michele Sindona was an international financier, a dyed-in-the-wool fascist himself with connections very strongly tied to the Mafia and the CIA, in which both groups he was involved with in drug running, among other things. A massive financial speculator and also the most important advisor to Pope Paul VI, and Pope Paul VI's own personal man in the Vatican Bank, Archbishop Paul Marcinkus, the highest-ranking American in the Vatican. Archbishop Paul Marcinkus, a man who today, because of those interesting laws of the Lateran Treaty days, is safe in the Vatican, even though he dares not go outside because he would undoubtedly be arrested by Italian authorities for his various financial speculations with Vatican money. Now, this is Michele Sindona. Michele Sindona, a charter member of P2, himself involved in numerous political manipulations, involved in helping to put together and fund attempted coups by the right in Italy, because again, this is a fascist government. This is not just a banker's club. These are people who are intent on bringing fascism to Italy and other European countries. We mentioned that their involvement with the Greek colonel's coup in 1967, Sindona's direct involvement.
Sindona, by the way, also was a conduit of funds for many of these fascist scams, and many of those funds came from the Central Intelligence Agency.
Absolutely, and Sindona's contacts to the CIA mentioned at some length, and will probably be talked about more in the last broadcast. Now, also, Roberto Calvi. Roberto Calvi is going to feature fairly prominently, although he's already dead by the time of a lot of the things we're going to be talking about tonight. But his bank, the Banco Ambrosiano, the largest private bank in Italy, a bank also intimately tied to the P2, and in many ways a financial arm of the P2 because of Roberto Calvi's important position within P2, and as we will find out, apparently also a key player in the international guns for drugs trade. And we're going to be talking tonight, I won't go into that too much because we're going to be talking tonight at great length about how that fits into the whole scheme. But Roberto Calvi, almost a protege of Michele Sindona's, became the Vatican's official banker or official banking counselor, more or less, after Sindona was forced out of the scene by the collapse of his own financial empire. Calvi himself was, when his own banking empire, again built on not only political manipulation but financial fraud on a massive scale, mostly defrauding, of course, the innocent stockholders, and profiting people like Calvi and other P2 members and other fascist businessmen, and, strangely enough, profiting Archbishop Paul Marcinkus, the head of the Vatican Bank, in many illegal ways. When Calvi's empire fell apart, he was found hanged under London's Blackfriars Bridge, a quote-unquote suicide, which nobody who knows much about this case really believes was a suicide. Calvi is only one of many, many people who have died because of this case. We've talked about several of them. Michele Sindona is dead, poisoned in jail. Several of Licio Gelli's intimates are dead. Several of the police magistrates and police detectives involved in investigating the case are dead.
Also judges, a lot of judges.
Judges, yes. All kinds of people have been dropping like flies because this is basically the largest case in European history, probably of this sort, at least of that we know about.
We'll be looking at the continuing hit list again this evening, too. A lot of suspicious deaths connected with this whole scandal that we have not yet covered.
But now, one of the key things to look at when we're bearing in mind is we're going to be tying this in, again, putting out the last threads tonight before we start tying them together, as Dave said, next week. The thing to look at is we're looking at a pattern of manipulation on several levels. Dave mentioned the strategy of tension, the P2, the Italian right wing, aided and abetted by Western intelligence, notably the CIA, the plan of setting up political terror to manipulate the political situation, to blame it on the left, and to terrify the Italian electorate into allowing a push to the right on the part of the government. This also was augmented by many cases of actual attempts at fascist coups, at least one of which was probably aided and abetted by Muammar Gaddafi in some shape or form, and we'll be talking about that also tonight. Now, at the same time, the strategy of tension is going on in Italy. We mentioned Michele Sindona's involvement with, for instance, the Greek coup in 1967 that brought a fascist military government to Greece. At the same time, the Vatican Bank, in the person of Archbishop Paul Marcinkus, was rubber-stamping Banco Ambrosiano loans to dummy companies in places like Panama, which seemed to, from all accounts, all reliable accounts, seemed to have been impossible to have done without Marcinkus having realized what he was doing on behalf of the Vatican Bank. So we have the Vatican Bank essentially conspiring to back up fraudulent loans to non-existent companies in South and Central America, which were then turned around and handed to various fascist governments. Well, for what? Well, we're going to discover some of that tonight, but the term Operation Condor should hang somewhere in your memory where you can take it down later this evening and think about this active complicity of the Vatican in these loans, this money being handed to essentially right-wing governments, not essentially, right-wing governments that are essentially fascist in South and Central America for their own political betterment, because this is the larger plan. We're going to talk tonight about a money-making operation so vast that it beggars the imagination, most of it apparently directed by Western intelligence in one shape or form, or elements of Western intelligence. Certainly American intelligence is involved, obviously. Italian intelligence was keenly involved, the right wing in Italy and the military and intelligence. And we're going to look at this huge operation and how it was used directly to manipulate political events all over the world. And it'll begin to give you a better idea of why this huge operation could lead to the attempted assassination of a pope and the probable assassination of another pope, which we discussed before, Pope John Paul I, who died 33 days after becoming pope, just on the verge of pulling apart the Vatican Bank from scratch and beginning to investigate some of these, well, to use a mild euphemism, irregularities on Marcinkus's part.
Okay, now what we're going to be doing, again, for those of you who are still curious as to why we call this the Mediterranean merry-go-round, last week we started out in North America, then we jumped over to Italy and then toured around the rest of Europe. Then we crossed back over the Atlantic to Latin America, then went back up into the Northern Hemisphere to North America again. Now this evening, we're going to start out in Southern Africa, then we're going to move up to Northern Africa and the Middle East. We're going to circle around the Mediterranean, wind up back in Italy for a while. Then we're going to jump back over to the United States, and we're going to hover around North America for a while. Then we're going to slide back down to Latin America, and eventually we're going to slide back over to Italy after that. So if you were wondering why we call it the Mediterranean merry-go-round, fasten your seatbelts, because we're going to be going around and around this evening.
Now, besides all these geographic perambulations, we are going to be also following up on a very important part, and it's a lot of this is in the subtext, but we will try and make it explicit whenever possible. We are going to be beginning, continuing to delve into the Bulgarian theory, which, of course, is what most people, when they hear about the shooting of John Paul II, the big lie has been so effectively spread That's what most people think of. Oh, yeah, the Bulgarians tried to kill him on behalf of the KGB. Now, we talked last week briefly about Michael Ledeen, an American quote-unquote journalist who is actually a political operative and has been for some time, has been linked to the CIA, is strongly linked to Alexander Haig and also to a variety of other conservative organizations. We talked about Michael Ledeen and his active manipulation of Italian politics and his role in a bunch of bizarre schemes, his connections to a man named Francesco Pazienza, who is going to come up next week at some length. Michael Ledeen is, of course, along with Claire Sterling, one of the primary disseminators of the Bulgarian thesis. And as we have been explaining, most of the people who are involved with the Bulgarian thesis and who have been pushing it so hard are not by any means real journalists in the normal sense, but these are all people who have actively worked on behalf of Western intelligence in Italy specifically. Both Claire Sterling and Michael Ledeen have worked on behalf of Western intelligence, in some cases actually breaking the laws of Italy to support the right wing there. So now, just as we mentioned that last week, this week we are going to begin to see how some of the half-truths that comprise the Bulgarian thesis, where they come from, where the actual connections through Eastern Europe are, but who those connections actually belong to, who they're being used by, and what those connections actually entail. So keep your eyes open when we get to the Eastern European part of our broadcast, that's going to sort of parallel the Middle Eastern part of our broadcast tonight, because you'll begin to see how these people have manipulated the facts and taken something and turned it completely around to try and pin it on the Bulgarian government, when in reality, well, you'll see.
Right.
Okay, without further ado then, we made a pretty quick summary there. We are going to jump into the broadcast tonight. We're going to start out with an article from the Washington Post of October 29th, 1985. This article is provided by Mae Brussel, as Dave mentioned, premier researcher in this field. And the article is headlined, Vatican Bank Subsidiary Tied to Loans to South Africa. The article is by John Perry, a special to the Washington Post, Dateline Geneva. The World Council of Churches, in a report issued prior to the Pope's just-concluded trip to Africa, has accused the Swiss subsidiary of the Vatican Bank of participating in loans to South Africa. The bank, in a statement, admitted it has made loans to, quote, clients in that country, but said the loans were not destined for the South African government. However, the World Council report, prepared by researcher Eva Millitz, said the loans went to semi-state enterprises such as the Postal and Telecommunications Organization and the South African Transport Services, along with the city of Johannesburg. The Council's report on bank loans to South Africa mid-1982-84 was prepared by Millitz with funds granted by the Council's program to combat racism. The Vatican is not a member of the Geneva-based Council, a multi-denominational ecumenical organization that seeks to promote religious harmony. Pope John Paul II, in his seven-nation tour through Africa, which ended last night, spoke out strongly against South Africa's racial segregation policies and the violence they have engendered in recent weeks. The World Council report, however, said the Instituto per le Opere di Religione, the IOR, otherwise known as the Vatican Bank, has been actively lending to South Africa through its subsidiary, Banco di Roma per la Svizzera. IOR, the Vatican Bank, owns 51% of the bank, based in the southern Swiss city of Lugano, and the Banco di Roma, the other 49%. In a brief comment on the council report, the Lugano Bank said its participation in loans to South Africa had been, quote, modest and confined to private clients. Millitz's report identified recipients of these loans, mostly co-managed by West German banks, as quasi-public entities rather than private clients. She said in a foreword to her report that her information came from regularly published banking sources. Now, in and of itself, the fact of the Vatican Bank making loans to South Africa is interesting as a moral issue and as a side political issue. But it's also interesting for a variety of other reasons. And one of them we talked about very briefly the week before, when we talked about the fact that John Paul II, in an effort to imitate or attempt to appear to imitate his predecessor in cleaning up the Vatican Bank, brought in a team of three experts, which was later augmented by a fourth expert, and to oversee the Vatican Bank's affairs, and this team of experts later wound up giving the Vatican Bank a clean bill of health. Well, as we mentioned, these experts were a mighty strange group, and we're going to be talking about one of them in just a few minutes.
Okay, now the main name to remember, we'll be introducing it in this article, but the name to remember in connection with the Vatican banking scandals, and this individual was called in to supposedly help straighten those out, the man's name is Philippe Devecq, or Philippe Devecq, W-E-C-K is his last name. And remember also his bank, the Union Bank of Switzerland, also known as the Union of Swiss Banks, the UBS. That's a key institution. It's going to come back later in the broadcast, as will Mr. Devec. Following article was researched for us by Ted Rubenstein, an excellent researcher who's been sharing his work with us for a long time and whose work is going to be playing a prominent role in the whole broadcast this evening. Ted got this from a publication called African Business from their issue of July of 1984. This article is headlined, Did the Pro-Apartheid Lobby Cash In on the Sniffer Planes? We very briefly referred to the Sniffer Plane scandal in our first broadcast. We'll be talking about it at greater length right now. Again, from African Business, July 1984. In December of 1983, France was rocked by scandal. The state oil corporation, ELF-ERAP, had wasted $250 million between 1976 and 79 on an imaginative but bogus invention to detect oil underground, first from the ground and then by the air. The repercussions of the affair, including legal proceedings against the major actors and parliamentary commissions of inquiry, continue. But unrevealed so far have been the details of how the hoax involved some of the most prominent European members of the extreme right-wing lobby establishment and the pro-apartheid lobby. The story begins behind the crumbling walls of the Rivieren Castle near Brussels, home of Count Alain de Villegas, V-I-L-L-E-G-A-S, eccentric, visionary, and dowsing fanatic. In the course of his esoteric studies, the Count made the acquaintance of another inventor, the Italian engineer Aldo Bonassoli, who was to become his partner throughout the Sniffer Planes affair. They soon decided to set up in business, and, requiring funds, approached the Count's father-in-law, Florimond Damant, D-A-M-M-A-N, a well-connected financier and familiar figure in the circles of the wealthy extreme right wing, who died in 1979. De Villegas seems to have successfully convinced Damant of the validity of a method to discover water deposits by magnetometry, measuring the Earth's magnetic field. In seeking further assistance, Damant enlisted the help of Paris lawyer Jean Violet. The oil hoax would not have worked without something credible to get it started. This came from the blue-chip political connections and from a series of apparently successful experiments in water divining in the Almeria region of Spain, which were facilitated by Damant's connection with General Franco's tourism and information minister, Alfredo Sanchez Bela. With the Spanish experiment behind them, the hoaxers tried to interest backers in oil prospecting. Through their political connections, they attracted Carlo Pesenti, P-E-S-E-N-T-I, an Italian businessman on the board of the giant Mont Edison Chemicals multinational, who is suspected of being a fundraiser for the MSI, the Italian Neo-Fascist Party. Pesenti went to South Africa between 1973 and 76 to carry out tests with the sniffer planes. But it was to help South Africa gain immunity from possible oil boycotts that most of the prime movers got involved. Many indeed had strong connections with the South African government and with its secret propaganda project. This is a very fine print here, reduced size article, so bear with me. For Damant, de Villegas, and Jean Violet, the independence for South Africa, oil independence for South Africa was the prize, and it was on this basis that they won the support of the eminent Gaullist veteran politician Antoine Pinay, P-I-N-A-Y. Between them, Violet and Pinay took the next step, which was to involve the state oil corporation. However, there is no proof of Pinay and Violet knew that the whole project was a hoax. But large sums of the money spent by ELF and the South African government on de Villegas and Bonassoli went to right-wing parties, and aspects of the affair begin to shade into the murky world of right-wing groups and intelligence agencies. Pinay and Violet were centrally involved in groups that turned out in the late 1970s to have been financed by the secret slush fund set up by Information Minister Connie Mulder and his sidekick, Eshel Rudi, R-H-O-O-D-I-E is that last man's last name. The sniffer surveys in South Africa proved inconclusive, and although interest remained, Pesenti pulled out in 1976. The inventors had to find new backers. This they did, again in ultra-conservative circles, in the form of Philippe Devec, president of the Union Bank of Switzerland. Devec became treasurer of the holding company Fisalma, in which de Villegas was the main shareholder, and money was raised to carry out a series of tests for the French government. The tests, unquote, were declared successful, and ELF decided to pay up. Shortly after the contract was signed, the then-president Valéry Giscard d'Estaing was informed of the discovery in the course of a visit from ELF chairman Pierre Guillaumat and Pinay. ELF had just paid out 200 million Swiss francs, $80 million, for the exclusive rights to the equipment. Given the political motivations involved, it is unsurprising that the new exploration efforts were launched in South Africa despite the earlier failures there. The South African government has admitted that it spent tens of millions of rands on the sniffer planes, probably during these surveys. They were started by SOREPMAS, ELF's South African subsidiary, on the 10th of May, 1977. So far, little attention has been drawn to any collaboration there may have been between ELF and South Africa's oil procurement authorities. However, by November, large deposits were being found by the equipment, but by August 1978, other investigations had made it clear there was nothing there. Tests were abandoned, but further exploration continued in Gabon and Morocco without anyone being aware of the bogus nature of the machinery. In the Reef and Garb provinces of Morocco, large deposits were supposed to have been found in August 1978, prompting King Hassan to declare to Parliament, "The most pessimistic view of these deposits still shows that they can cover all our diplomatic oil, all our domestic oil needs," unquote. From February of 1978 to May of 1979, tests continued offshore in Gabon. Results were negative, but ELF still signed a new contract with the inventors in June of 78, giving ELF exclusive use and access to the machines on the payment of 250 million francs, $150 million. Present at the signing of the contract were Devec, Albin Chalandon, the new head of ELF, and Pinet and Violet. By now, the many test failures should have exposed the hoax, but ELF was now committed and could not afford to back out without incontrovertible evidence. Getting oil for South Africa was still a major priority, and if the method proved itself, its value could run into billions in any currency. In the event, the hoax only came to light because of deep rivalries within the Giscard administration. Then goes on to describe that basically a proponent of nuclear power, in order to grind his own political axe, exposed the scandal. We're not going to go into that because it's fairly lengthy. Skipping down in the article, but what of the money? By May of 1984, the liquidator had recovered 150 million francs, but some stayed with de Villegas, according to the French Parliamentary Commission. Some $2.8 million went to a charity called Châteauneuf de Galore. More mysterious is the destiny of some $4 million, which supposedly went to a third world aid foundation, Air Antenea, which is completely unknown to aid workers, but which is chaired by Devec and other members of the Union Bank Board. Apparently, $800,000 of the $4 million went to dig wells in Niger, but aid workers in that country claim to have never heard of the project. Of the rest, $16 million went to the Pacente Group for the cost of the surveys in South Africa, and some $44 million is still unaccounted for. De Villegas has now gone to ground somewhere in the U.S., others say in Colombia, but the destination of the rest of the funds may perhaps be guessed at from the connections of the original backers of the scheme. Florimond Damin was secretary of the European Academy of Political Science, EAPS, an organization closely linked in the past with the European-wide extreme right. He was a member of the Belgian Rhodesia Association, and Damin and de Villegas, who was also in the EAPS, both had connections with the World Anti-Communist League, a body once funded by the CIA and now an international meeting place of neo-fascists and other members of the extreme right. In 1979, the Johannesburg Star newspaper claimed that Antoine Pinet was one of those who collaborated with the Muldergate secret projects, quote, out of political conviction, not self-interest, unquote. Pinet was the honorary president in 1977 of the Association of Franco-South African Communities, which was one of the secretly financed pro-South African organizations. Jean Violet has also been closely connected with the French pro-apartheid lobby, and the French Parliamentary Commission referred to his ambiguous role. Most astonishing and provocative was a recent revelation by the West German magazine Spiegel, which published a letter by Hans Langemann, L-A-N-G-E-M-A-N-N, an important senior official in Bavarian intelligence on 7th of March, 1980. The letter, outlining who was who in the pro-South African lobby, mentions that in December of 1979, Pinet was present at a secret meeting in Washington, D.C. between ex-director of the CIA William Colby, Federal Reserve Bank Chief Paul Volckers, Italian Cabinet Minister Pandolfi, and the South African General Fraser. The exact purpose of this meeting is not yet known. Langemann's letter also states that he was sure, unquote, that Jean Violet had firm links with the intelligence services of the U.S., France, Britain, and Switzerland. Furthermore, the spy wrote, General Galen, when chief of the West German Foreign Intelligence Service, had paid Violet 6,000 Deutschmarks, or $2,000, per month. The scandal has largely been written off, and it remains to be seen whether the investigation will be properly followed through, and the role of South Africa, its connections with ELF, and the involvement of right-wing lobbyists fully explained. But there's a lot of information in that article and a lot of names. The most important ones to remember here are, of course, Philippe de Weck, president of the Union Bank of Switzerland and one of the people called in by Pope John Paul II to allegedly straighten out the Vatican financial mess. Key name also, Carlo Pesenti, P-E-S-E-N-T-I. As mentioned here, long suspected of being a fundraiser for the MSI, that's the Italian Fascist Party to which P2 member Vito Micheli and also Stefano Della Chiaia briefly belonged. Those are names from our last broadcast. And a couple of the other names to take note of here. Well, Hans Langemann is a name we haven't covered before. We're going to be talking about him in our next Radio Free America series in June at considerable length. Langemann was a member of the BND, the Gehlen Organization, the West German Federal Intelligence Service, which again began as Hitler's Eastern Front Intelligence Organization, then jumped in turn to the CIA, NATO, and finally West Germany, where it remains to this day. Now, note the connections of Florimond Desmonts and Mr. Violet with the World Anti-Communist League. Of course, we did a two-part Radio Free America series about the World Anti-Communist League. It is exactly as indicated here, an organization begun by U.S. intelligence, which has since become a meeting place for rightists of all sorts. And that's the connection to remember. Okay, the World Anti-Communist League, we began covering it in our last broadcast, and we'll be, we began covering connections between Wackel and this tangle here in our last broadcast. We'll be coming back to it again in, later in this broadcast and in the next one as well. Now, the key names to remember here for our purposes right now, of course, bear in mind that many of the same P2 players that we've been looking at are now aiding South Africa. Recall the Vatican Bank's assistance to South Africa and the relationship between P2 and the Vatican Bank. Now, Philippe de Weck was called in to straighten out the Vatican financial mess stemming from the collapse of the Banco Ambrosiano. Carlo Pesenti is a person who also had connections to the Banco Ambrosiano. As we'll see, Carlo Pesenti was a member of was a key official, a vice president specifically of the Vatican Bank, and we'll be coming back to him in a second. Of course, the fact that both Pesenti and Philippe de Weck were associated in this scandal, the sniffer plane scandal, makes it very, very suspicious, and that Philippe de Weck should have been called in to help straighten out a tangle of events involving, among others, Carlo Pesenti.
Yes, indeed. What we are going to look at here in a section from David Yalop's In God's Name is a little bit about Philippe de Weck. We should mention that of the four people who eventually became the commission of inquiry set up by the Vatican, set up specifically by John Paul II to look into these allegations. Two of them, as Yalop mentions, are extremely suspect, and we're going to read about Philippe de Weck a little more in a moment. We might also mention that the other one is Hermann Abs. Hermann Abs was the chairman of the Deutsche Bank, is the chairman of the Deutsche Bank, or was until just recently. He was also specifically, and most importantly for our purposes, chairman of the Deutsche Bank from 1940 to 1945. He was, in essence, Hitler's banker all over the world, because the Deutsche Bank was the German government's bank of choice all during World War II and all its occupied territories. Also, very important for our purposes, because of the fact that we have some kind of strange information about the Pope having been involved with an IG Farben subsidiary, of course, IG Farben, the massive German chemical combine, that the Pope apparently was affiliated in some way with one of them, perhaps as an unwilling worker, but it's not quite clear at this point, during World War II. Interestingly enough, Hermann Abs, one of the people that Pope John Paul II invited in to oversee the inquiry into the Vatican Bank's problems, not only a former top banker for the Nazis, but Hermann Abs also sat on the board of directors of IG Farben. Again, directors of IG Farben were the only civilians ever convicted of war crimes. And Hermann Abs certainly sat in on meetings at which the use of slave labor at Auschwitz was discussed. So this is a man who's being brought in to oversee basically a commission of inquiry on a fascist banking scandal.
And again, we know that the Pope used to work at an IG Farben complex in the Krakow vicinity. Whether it was one of the IG Auschwitz plants, we haven't absolutely determined. But if he was indeed a slave, as it has been maintained, ask yourself whether he would call in since Hermann Abs was the man who advanced the venture capital to build the IG Farben plants at Auschwitz, basically he was the slave master for the alleged slave, John Paul II. And the question that we ask, perhaps rhetorically, is if you were a slave, would you invite the person who had enslaved you to be your financial advisor once you'd become free?
That's right. Now, so this is Hermann Obst. He's one of the four wise men brought in to oversee this inquiry. We're going to read a little bit more from In God's Name.
Now, in addition to Philippe de Vac here, and remember Carlo Pacenti, and we're going to talk about his connection to Banco Ampresiano in a moment, the Union Bank of Switzerland, the UBS, is a very important institution and one to which we're going to come back later in the broadcast.
Okay, reading from David Yalop's book. The Commission of Inquiry comprises, quote, four wise men. Two of them, Yalop writes, by their presence on a commission of inquiry that Cardinal Casaroli has predictably called objective, Cardinal Casaroli is the Vatican Secretary of State, completely invalidate any findings that may eventually be reached. One is Philippe de Vec, the former chairman of UBS, Union de Banque Suisse of Zurich. De Vec still maintains very close links with the UBS. This is the bank that holds on behalf of Licio Gelli $55 million of the stolen money. It is the bank that holds on behalf of the late Roberto Calvi and Flavio Carboni over $30 million of the stolen money. It is the bank that holds on behalf of Carboni's Austrian mistress, Manuela Kleinzig, $2 million of the stolen money. Philippe de Vec is also the man at the center of what the French call the Sniffer Planes Affair. This involved a wonderful invention, the brainchild of an Italian technician, Aldo Bonassoli, and Count Alain de Viega, an elderly Belgian. The invention came in two parts, one housed in a plane that beamed back information to the second part on Earth. Cross-sections of the geological strata many thousands of feet below the Earth's surface were then seen as technical data on a computer screen. The potential was limitless. Along with instant mineral and oil prospecting at a fraction of the traditional cost, there were also military implications. Any eye that could locate oil thousands of feet below the Earth's surface could also pinpoint a submerged nuclear submarine. Encouraged by President Giscard d'Estaing, the French oil giant ELF poured about $120 million into the Count's Panamanian company, Fisalma. Interesting, by the way, that it's a Panamanian-based company because, of course, as we mentioned earlier, the Vatican Bank was the one that issued the backup for the Banco Ambrosiano to send money to dummy companies in Panama. Viega was the sole shareholder, and the company was administered by Philippe de Vec. By the time the French realized that lay sting had been played on them, $60 million had vanished. De Vec told the French that the money had gone to research and, quote, charitable works. One of the men acting for UBS, Zurich, who had been keeping an eye on this pioneering work in the art of international theft, was Ernst Keller, who at the same time was also a shareholder of Ultrafine AG, a Roberto Calvi-owned company linked to Ambrosiano Holding Luxembourg. Ultrafine was the conduit by which the Count's Panamanian company received its initial payments. So we have Philippe de Vec, who's administering the company that is taking the money for this giant sting. The company is also affiliated to another company, which is a Calvi-owned Ambrosiano company, that is the conduit that gets the money to this dummy company. And here's Philippe de Vec, the man who is involved in one of these grotesque scams, who's being brought in to oversee the Vatican Bank's grotesque scams and is going to serve on the Commission of Inquiry with the former Nazi banker Hermann Obst to give the whole thing a clean bill of health. Well, folks, this makes great theater, but it's not even very good politics. I mean, this is so bloody obvious as to what's going on that I think you would have to be pretty much of a dummy not to realize that lay scam is in lay gear in earnest.
And again, remember UBS, its connections to Licio Gelli, to Flavio Carboni, a Roberto Calvi associate, and to Carlo Pacenti. And, well, remember DeVec's connections to UBS, and in turn, DeVec's connections to Carlo Pacenti. Carlo Pacenti, among others, although he was quite old, was a person who died precipitously during the course of the investigation into P2, the Banco Ambrosiano, and so forth. His obituary was published in the San Francisco Chronicle on September 22nd, 1984. The story is an AP story, Dateline Montreal, and just simply headed Carlo Pacenti. Carlo Pacenti, a prominent Italian businessman who was vice president of the Banco Ambrosiano when it collapsed 2 years ago, died of heart failure Thursday, doctors said. The 77-year-old Pacenti, in Canada on business, was admitted to Montreal General Hospital on September 15th after suffering a heart attack. Pacenti and seven other bank directors were ordered in June to face charges arising from Italy's worst post-war banking crash. He had been living with his family in Monte Carlo. Pacente was an executive at the bank while Roberto Calvi was its president. Calvi was found hanged under a Thames River bridge in London in 1982. Pacente, again, was 77 years old. People who are 77 do experience heart failure. It is worth noting, though, that he managed to live 77 healthy years until about 3 months after he was indicted in the Banco Ambrosiano scandal, at which point he died. A lot of people, again, 77-year-olds do die. One of the things is, however, that we have looked at in the past and we'll be looking at again is how many of these people die as soon as their names come up in the investigation.
That's right. If Carlo Pacente had been the only one to die, we would be willing to grant the benefit of doubt on the side of accident. But, however, as we have been talking about and we'll continue to talk about, is there like 30 or 40 people that have bit the proverbial dust immediately after their names have surfaced or they've gotten involved with this thing somehow, one has to cast a cold eye. Here's another gentleman who met a perhaps more untimely fate, directly linked in at the very least to this whole case. This is from the San Jose Mercury News of October 2nd, 1982. The headline is "Official of Tainted Bank Killed." Dateline Milan. A deputy director of the scandal-haunted Ambrosiano Bank jumped to his death from a window of one of the bank's headquarters Friday, the third bank official to commit suicide since the scandal broke in June. Giuseppe Della Cha, last name spelled D-E-L-L-A-C-H-A, age 54, deputy director at the bank's main office, scrawled a farewell note on his desk calendar before he made the suicide leap from a fifth-floor balcony, police said. Addressed to his wife and two children, the note said, quote, "It is all my fault. Kisses to Milena, Susie, and Gabriella, Papa." Now, it should be noted that also Roberto Calvi's secretary, I think just before Roberto Calvi was found dead, if I've got my chronology correct.
It was either a day before or a day afterward.
Yeah,
I can't remember which.
Right in that general area. Also took a flyer, maybe even out of the same building.
I think this guy went out the fifth and she went out the fourth.
Right, so just a floor difference. Again, people do commit suicide, but it's interesting that Michele Sindona, under police guard night and day in prison, managed to quote-unquote possibly commit suicide by somehow getting cyanide into his own food, and that Roberto Calvi, who had been running around England for several days in terror of his life, managed to stuff his pockets with bricks and hang himself from the underside of Blackfriars Bridge, another suicide. And here we have another gentleman writing a suicide note that says it's all my fault and flinging himself out of the window. Roberto Calvi's secretary, her suicide note said it's all Calvi's fault and flung herself out of a window. A lot of window flinging, a lot of strange deaths.
Also a man, his last name began with T. I think it was something like Tronky or Tronky, another member of
Trokey.
The... Trokey, that was it, who basically was involved with the Vatican Incorporated and the P2 scandal. He also conveniently committed suicide. And then there are people like John Paul I, who died simply as a result of an act of God, if one can believe that. The late Carlo Pacente passed on. We're going to look at a lot of people whose mortality came to light in a big way as soon as the scandals began to break. The Della Casa obituary that we just read is sort of a non sequitur, does not relate that directly to the material this evening. However, as long as we're getting this stuff on archive, we thought we'd include that. Now, remember that he went out the fifth floor. Calvi's secretary went out the fourth floor. This Banco Ambrosiano headquarters in Milan is a very interesting building. We're going to be talking about just how interesting it was. Is apparently still later in the broadcast.
If nothing else, you'd certainly want to, if you're going to walk past it, you'd want to be looking up as you did so. You know,
yeah, or
I mean?
If you're going down, you like they say, watch out for the first step. It's a Lulu. Now, we're going to be talking about another near killing. Well, in fact, a couple of people did die, although not the intended victim. Another very key shooting at this very same building or just outside of it. And this is going to bear directly, two of the names in particular are going to bear very directly on some information connecting with an arms for drugs ring that figures in the shooting of the Pope. So remember the two names, I'll give them to you before Nip reads them, Balducci and Abruciati. Actually, before I read them here, Balducci and Abruciati are the two key names here.